This is CliffCentral.com.
It's Thursday morning, means we get to check in on all the important events of the last couple of days, find out what people think of them, and let you get your little snackables, you know, those things that you can just deliver, like profound wisdom at the water cooler or the coffee shop or the restaurant down the road, maybe even the staff meeting. You get to drop these things in and people go, wow, how the hell did you know all of that? Well, it's because we leverage the opinions of people like Gareth van Onselen and Canthan Pillay and many others. And Gareth wrote this brilliant article that I'd like to start the Burning Platform with this morning, because I think it must have caused quite a lot of noise on social media. And even if it didn't cause noise there, because that isn't always the best place to cause noise, it certainly got people talking in the EFF. The Burning Platform every week, Thursday at this time, brought to you by Nando's. And we get into some stories that are in the news. We'll talk a little bit about Thabo Mbeki this morning. I haven't spoken about him in ages. And some other things. But Gareth van Onselen, nice to see you, man.
Thanks for having me, Gareth. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's always nice to talk to you because you set fire to things and then you watch them burn. And online, that's usually the most interesting strategy. You wrote this article about the disintegration of the EFF, which people are welcome to go and read on Business Day, among other things, as long as you're not so cheap that you won't get behind the paywall.
Yes.
Yeah. You've been watching this party for a long time, and I think this is a great place to start the Burning Platform this morning, because people don't know what's going on. The ANC looks like it's neither here nor there. Cyril can't get involved, doesn't want to get involved, sometimes pretends to get involved, but it seems there's no real energy behind leadership in the ANC at the moment, because they can't decide which faction they're going to let win. The DA is also pretty rudderless, as you've indicated in previous articles of yours, but the one thing that's been fairly constant is that the EFF have had solid messaging. They've had their one big target almost all the time, whether it's been land, whether it's been Jacob Zuma. Now suddenly, you're saying in this article, they look like they're directionless.
Yeah, look, I think there are a number of problems for the EFF, and I mean, some of them are the same problems that have, you know, reduced the DA to a kind of twilight zone party. I mean, the fact that Zoom is gone and the EFF put so much emphasis and energy but behind getting rid of him at the expense of everything else, that they kind of left flailing now without him is one factor. Their fallout with the media, the extent to which they've turned on individuals, and the mainstream press seems to have now gone from a kind of coddling attitude to condemnation.
Yeah, because you can't deny that the media were fawning over Julius and his revolutionary ideas and his charisma and all of that stuff. In fact, it was pretty much all that our local press was interested in for a very long time. And he got them the clicks and he got them the interest and the headlines, and they like that because it makes their business easier.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a combination of his kind of, you know, extreme rhetoric, which, as you say, made for very good sales, but also a misunderstanding of who he was and what he was about. And a refusal to see the kind of things, or to take the kind of things that he said on their own terms. And it's, you know, it took him turning on the media themselves and you know, going directly after a number of high-profile, big-name media people for them to realize this stuff wasn't all fun and games.
But doesn't that tell you something about our media business? Is that only when it really started to hit home and get personal and end up being something that they were dealing with at their own places of residence and their offices, that our media started to realize the danger that he represented for ordinary citizens. It's only when it hurt them personally that they started to take this seriously. Our media like to have one set of rules for themselves and another set of rules for everybody else.
Yeah, look, I mean, one must be careful not to generalize. Not every single person in the media is like this, obviously, but I think a large contingent of the mainstream media are guilty of that kind of thing. And, I mean, you know, one of my takes on South African politics is that people don't listen enough to what people actually say. We're such a kind of conspiratorial society that everyone's looking for hidden meaning and double meaning and what does this mean?
You know, sometimes people just mean what they say.
I think a lot of time politicians mean what they say. And the ANC is notorious for this. It says what it plans to do. It writes it down in documents. It's all there in black and white. And it systematically implements that stuff.
Yeah, but then the intelligentsia, as much as the media and big business, all take that stuff and they interpret it as if, you know, it comes from some It comes from Genesis or Exodus or one of the chapters of the Bible and requires interpretation. Sometimes people just say what they mean. Like if they say they want to take healthcare and nationalize it and make it impossible for people to have private health insurance, maybe they actually mean that.
Yes, exactly. And well, I'll tell you what it is. It's projection. A lot of people project their own emotional states onto things that the ANC or the EFF says. They want it to mean something that it doesn't mean. I mean, it's exactly what's happened with Cyril Ramaphosa. There are a whole lot of high-profile media people who want him to succeed. And that's fine. Want him to succeed, be optimistic, be hopeful. But you can't turn his policy agenda, his attitudes, his positioning on certain things into hope and something that they're not. They're very different to that, and you have to analyze them for what they are.
Well, there are also lots of people on the left, whether they're in the media or in society, who have this dalliance with ideas like revolution and these very extreme leftist thoughts that Julius often is the one who promulgates. And sometimes the ANC are responsible for that too. The EFF have largely taken the ground on the left from the ANC, and it bothers them because they always used to be those people, right? They always used to be the ones who had the South African Communist Party is their think tank, and they were getting good ideas from socialist governments overseas, and this is where, during the struggle, a lot of the original planning for the ANC came from. Mm. Now, when they see the ugly teeth of people who are revolutionaries on the far left, it kind of upsets them because they thought, oh, but I thought we were friends. I thought we were lovers. I thought this was something we could do together.
Yes, no, I would agree with that 100%, but you can even take it one step further. To the extent that people aren't even, and this includes the left themselves, parties like the EFF, are not even serious about their own ideological core belief system. I mean, it's one of the points I make in this
article.
It's
hypocrisy when they're flying business class and they're drinking fancy champagne and whiskey. This is not how socialists are meant to behave.
Well, that's one element, but I'm talking about, in strict ideological terms, I mean,
right.
This idea of a revolutionary party is an idea that's thrown around with very little consideration. But if you look at history, it's actually a very well-defined, serious set of beliefs. And if you're a party, in fact, you shouldn't be a party in the formal democratic sense if you are a revolutionary movement. Your purpose is to operate outside of the state, not be enmeshed in the state, you know. Stalin or Mao or Lenin wouldn't go stand on the red carpet for photos at the State of the Nation address. The state itself is illegitimate in your view.
Right.
And your purpose is to overthrow it from the outside, not be enmeshed in it and try to operate within its systems. And in this sense, the EFF is a farce as a revolutionary party. It does not operate as a real revolutionary party. It operates as a pseudo-revolutionary party, and partakes in all the democratic processes and legitimizes them and is actually captured by the state in a certain regard.
Well, Canton Pillay is here to join us in this conversation. Canton, nice to see you again. And he's our returning champion on the Burning Platform. But before we get your comments on Garrett's article, I just want to finish talking about it from the point of view of having read it just yesterday. You say that they don't have an enemy to hate at the moment. They're almost fragmented in their hatred. And if you're going to be a good fascist, you need to have someone to focus on, whether it's in Hitler's case, the Jews, or whether it's in Stalin's case, the white Russians, the middle class, the bourgeoisie, you know?
Yes, you need to attach your hate to something concrete, as I wrote in the article. You need to... you can't just hate the Jews. You need to demonstrate that the Jews are manipulating the economy. Now, the EFF does have a conspiratorial theory along those lines.
White monopoly capital. Which ironically,
you guys said that in stereo. That was really good.
But that's also ironic because that was made up by the Guptas and an international spin doctoring institute, that white monopoly capital thing. And the EFF have somehow just subsumed it into their own policy.
Yes, well, as ever, it actually has its roots in ANC documents going further back, but it was popularized in the terms that you've set out, and the EFF, which takes so much of its ideas from, you know, its time when it was the ANC Youth League and before. That's where these ideas take root in the EFF.
There are some who believe it's still the ANC Youth League.
Oh, I totally think it's just an extension of the ANC. But the point is that it has become so bad at managing that idea, and it has spent so much time trying to say that the real perpetrators or implementators of white monopoly capital ideals are the ANC itself, which is just not credible to the majority of South Africans, that it's ruined any kind of cachet that idea had. And so it suffers this kind of disparate firefighting effort now on 100 different fronts with no real direction or purpose.
Well, Canton, did you manage to read the article?
I did not manage to read the article, but everything that Gareth's said so far, I've pretty much tended to agree with. But we've been talking about this stuff on this show for quite a while, that there's this really blinkered approach on the part of commentators who desperately want to say, well, what Cyril actually means. No, he literally means what he says.
Yeah. It's an interesting way of looking at things. I feel that Cyril now, just today, there's been this news report about how he's now taking gender-based violence very seriously. And like so many other complicated issues in South Africa, this is not something that the government can solve. Corporal punishment is now something which, I mean, Canton, I know you're a parent. You are not allowed, not that I thought that you would, you're not allowed to decide what discipline is appropriate for your children anymore, particularly when it comes to moderate chastisement.
Well, this is another red herring. The Constitutional Court ruled on this in 1995. They said that corporal punishment was a no-go.
And I mean, if you're not allowed to hit your spouse, you shouldn't be allowed to hit your children. That makes perfect sense to me.
Pretty much so.
But this is another example of how the state is being used as the best possible organ to take care of everything, including what goes on in your own family. And I don't know that that's such a good idea. Let's put aside that you shouldn't be hitting your children, because I think morally that's probably something most people would agree is not a good thing. But let's look at what people are proposing here. They're slowly giving more and more authority and more power and prominence to the state. And I don't know that that's a good thing. Gender-based violence, the state's going to solve that? This is a social problem.
Well, this entire idea that the state is somehow responsible for our safety is totally absurd. And the entire concept of needing someone to stand up in parliament and say, we are going to take responsibility for your safety. No, actually, as a species, we've constantly ended up, you know, basically beating the shit out of each other our entire lives. And really what we need to try and do is to take responsibility for that stuff ourselves. Does that mean that I feel that women don't have the right to walk safely wherever they want to? Of course, I want them to be able to walk safely wherever they want to. But to entrust the responsibility for that to the state, how utterly absurd is that? Really, the whole idea is give every single woman a gun and let her actually shoot the shit out of anyone who comes up and makes an untoward remark. And, you know, we'd solve half of our overpopulation problems overnight.
Well, Gareth's bristling slightly. Go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I agree. The state is stretching its tentacles into all sections of South African life where it shouldn't be. And a lot of that is a response to a series of moral panics. And people immediately, because we're a very authoritarian and deferential society, think the state can solve all of our problems. But the problem with the kind of liberal response to that is that it does negate any proper understanding of society itself. And let me tell you, society out there is a sick place. Mm. I mean, if you want to do a moral comparison, the state or the judiciary, whoever's responsible, has outlawed the death penalty in South Africa. That, in my book, is a plus point for the state and the judiciary.
Absolutely, yeah.
The South African people, who we want to leave to, you know, have guns and take care of themselves, murdered 800 people, communities of their own volition, in kind of mob justice killings
last year,
do it every year.
Right.
And so, you know, and you look at all the big elements that, you know, as liberals, we traditionally put a lot of emphasis on as the kind of mainstay pillars of a society, things like the family. The South African family is in utter and total disarray.
Yeah.
Fatherless households, abuse, murders, you know, it is just a wreck. And a lot of stuff has to be done. And I'm not sure how you go about doing it, because these are very complex problems and you want to negate the state dictating terms on this front to fix the social fabric of South Africa. It is profoundly broken.
All right. But then can I ask you both for your advice on a very finite set of parameters that we've got going on in the Western Cape at the moment. We have a massive gang violence problem. We have a massive drug problem. We have community safety issues. We have children being recruited into gangs. We have communities who are complaining all the time about these gangs, yet they're the ones who are giving them succor. We were talking earlier this week, and we couldn't come to any meaningful conclusion, and I'd like to have your thoughts on this. With the army going into the Western Cape, that immediately is something that makes people who believe in a free society uncomfortable. Mm. When the army rolls into, the army's job is to protect outside, to protect the borders, to make sure that existential threats are kept at bay. They're not there to do safety and security. Safety and security is the police's job. Clearly, the police have failed. They're a complete failure in this respect, especially in the Western Cape. Maybe they're corrupt. Maybe there are a lot of other factors that come into it. But sending the army in, on the face of it, is obviously not something anybody who respects a free society would be pleased with. However, it seems that this has had some positive effects in some areas. And
I've been waiting for the actual stats. I've been putting that down to spin.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So you don't believe any of it yet?
No, I don't believe any of it yet.
You think it might have done less good than kept things?
Pretty much. I think right now there's actually an attempt to show that things are actually working to some extent. And
when they aren't.
And they aren't. Because, I mean, currently they're desperate to actually try and create the impression that...
That there is a government.
That there is a government, that they're capable of actually getting stuff back
so
on track.
So what are your thoughts on this? Because we hear from the Western Cape government that they welcome the army being pulled into the
Look, I think this has been one of the few cases where I disagreed very strongly with Helen Zille in terms of whether the army should be brought in. My fundamental take on the way in which an army is supposed to work is that the type of muscle memory that these guys have is very different to the type of muscle memory that police officers have. Because if you're a soldier, essentially your muscle memory is to take out the enemy first.
Well, Pumi made the point the other day, which I thought was quite relevant. She said, the army are not trained to arrest people.
Yes.
They just shoot people.
Exactly. Yes. And do you really want to be turning that loose in that particular scenario? Now, no doubt there's a number of people who think that that's an excellent thing. Let's just take out anyone, you know.
Well, these are the same people Gareth was talking about just now with their kangaroo courts.
Yeah, shoot.
Go through the process of justice?
Yeah, kill them all and let God sort them out is the approach that they generally take.
Right.
Look, the question of the townships themselves, and particularly the Western Cape townships. Mm-hmm. I was on a flight to Cape Town not so long ago with someone who's actually become extremely wealthy by launching a startup that actually tracks homing pigeons around the world.
Really?
Fascinating guy. And, you know, born and bred in the Cape Flats and really bright, brilliant stuff. And we spent ages talking about it. And we were talking about the entire scenario in terms of what happens in the Cape Flats townships, especially because, you know, I lived a number of years out there in Cape Town in, you know, 1997 through to 2003. And I'm really quite familiar in terms of where the violence hotspots are in terms of all of the various suburbs and the stuff that drives them, the type of gangs that are behind them and so forth. Mm-hmm. And he made a very significant point, which is that there used to be three points of stability that used to get provided in the townships. And the three points of stability were really three forms of authority. So the one were the religious institutions.
Right.
The second was the gangs, because the gangs actually provide structure to a large extent. So even though they're indulging in all of these criminal activities, they're actually providing some sort of framework within which
It may be a different kind of society, but it is a society.
It is a society, exactly. But the third point that he made was that the most crucial thing that used to hold the townships together used to be sport. And at the point at which you had forced integration of sports and sporting facilities, that's when the structure of sport as something that actually pulls people together actually broke down. So it was a fascinating argument.
Why has sport broken down?
Well, it's broken down because the whole idea, I mean...
Now we have a ministry of sport.
Well,
think that that would have helped.
Well, if you consider, for example, back during the apartheid era, your soccer teams really were determined by your geographic location, the racial composition of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a soccer team coming from Athlone, for example, would be overwhelmingly people who'd be referred to as coloureds historically.
Right.
And, you know, a soccer team coming from Chatsworth in Durban would be historically Indian. Right. And you really had this insistence on forced integration that came along, which then broke down the social structures that came with those soccer teams, which has resulted in sport no longer being a point that people can gravitate to. I mean, essentially that means you're currently stuck between the structure of either the evangelical religious fanatics or that of the gangs who, you know, basically are teaching you to peddle drugs and shoot and so forth. It's an interesting theory. It's one which I need to pay more attention to at some point. But do I think that bringing the army is a good thing? No, but it ends in tears.
Gareth, anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, that stuff's very interesting from a sociological perspective, and like Kanth and I'd have to have a look at you know, some more considered studies on that stuff to comment on it. But just on the state side, and the reason the army is there is because, as you say, the police have failed, but they've failed in a very particular way. I mean, the ANC has failed to deploy police to the Western Cape in numbers vaguely comparable with the way in which they're deployed in the rest of the country. And the only conclusion you can come to is that it's some kind of political slight against the DA government.
Well, we know this. We know that this is the most hotly contested region. The ANC have got no real hope of regaining control of the Western Cape, as we've seen in just the last couple of elections. They've failed ultimately in winning black and coloured voters over there. And now they're resorting to some very sly scheming tactics to make it very difficult for the Western Cape government to actually run the province.
Yes, and although
because resources are controlled by national government.
Correct. And of course, I mean, the other question you have to ask is, even if they did deploy the right numbers, whether these people are competent and professional enough to actually turn the problem around.
We know they're not.
Yeah. So you've got the army, and the army's a, you know, a problem for all the reasons we've said, one of which is precedent. I mean, these riots that are taking place in Johannesburg, David Makuru's first response was to suggest, well, let's deploy the army here as well.
Jeez.
And before you know it, that becomes your standard response to anything the police can't control, which, as things stand, is pretty much everything.
Well, what do government have a handle on at the moment? Because there are still these fans of Cyril, who you spoke about earlier, whether they're in the media or in big business or wherever else, who are saying that, oh, no, he's playing this long game and he's got 4D chess on his side and he's extraordinarily clever and he's got a whole long-term plan. And it's really just taking a long time to unwind. And you'll see it, you small-minded people, you'll see it eventually when it manifests itself in all its glory.
If you want to understand how the long-term planning of the ANC actually works, I don't know if you guys had a chance to take a listen to the stuff that Thabo Mbeki had to say at the Mugabe Memorial Lecture in KZN yesterday.
Mm. I was going to bring it up, but go on.
Okay, well, the thing that kind of struck me was that he made the point that when he was in discussions with Mugabe at the time, remember that we were coming into the whole process of negotiation 10 years after Zimbabwe's independence. So in other words, it was 10 years after Lancaster House.
Mm-hmm.
And at the expiration of the Lancaster House agreement, the idea was that that was the point at which Zimbabweans would be able to change the constitution mm-hmm. and to be able to put in things like expropriation without compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And the ANC actually persuaded Mugabe not to implement expropriation without compensation at that point, because they did not want white South Africans to be afraid of the ANC doing exactly the same thing in South Africa.
Well, what's changed?
Well, what you see,
because that's not what the ANC wants now.
Yes, but what I'm trying to say is that back then they were already scheming with the whole idea that, look, at some point we're going to be implementing expropriation without compensation, but we don't want the Zimbabwean example.
Don't panic our whites.
Don't panic our whites at this point until we've actually got them safely in the corral so that we can shoot the shit out of them afterwards. So there's long-term planning. It's exactly the stuff we're talking about. The NDR, it's how old is it as a document, Gareth? 70 years old, something like that?
Yeah, long time.
Isn't it time for an update? I mean, we're talking about stuff that is just not geopolitically relevant anymore.
But from ensuring the power of the ruling party, it's entirely relevant.
Well, this is the thing with Zimbabwe, and I'm glad you brought up Thabo Mbeki in the memorial lecture, because Robert Mugabe was this idea of how badly things can go wrong. And yet there are still people, including, you know, our friend Julius that we started this conversation with this morning, who regard him as having been a tremendous success. And I'm not talking about a success as in running the country to the satisfaction of the majority of his citizens or trying to make things work on a very basic level. I'm talking about success as in he stayed in power until the very bitter end. And to politicians and to political animals, that is the most important and the only sign of any kind of success.
Well, and ideological success. I mean, the whole thing about Mbeki's speech was this kind of abstract ideological assessment of how he had fought the West and established Africa, or helped to establish Africa as a kind of independent zone. There was not a single hard human indicator in that speech. He did not track whether poverty's gone up or down, how the Zimbabwean dollar's done, the number of houses
it's
built,
all
education.
Paper stuff.
And that's, yeah, I mean, that is the real test of a government, is the extent to which you provide an environment for people to improve their own lives. And any interest in that at all. An entirely doctrinarian kind of ideological assessment of a man that existed off in some imagined plane in the sky and not down on the ground. I mean, it was a shocking, shocking
lecture.
Isn't
this the problem with utopians? And many people in the grip of some ideological, you know, set of ideas, these people live in this utopian world. I mean, I hear the current Minister of Health who says, no, this is not like Eskom. As if in his imagination he's compartmentalized some fancy place where everything just happens and there's plenty of resources and everybody's healthy and hospitals are not a disaster. The very department he presides over at the moment is a clusterfuck. Yes. There's no other way to put it. And yet he's able to imagine some far-off place where somehow, miraculously, it'll all just come right.
Ugh, look,
how do they factor this into their day-to-day work?
Everyone does that to a degree. I mean, one of the responses to all the xenophobia and rioting is for people to say this is un-South African behavior, you know, whereas actually if you look at our history and the crime stats, is perfectly South African behavior. It's exactly what we do, yes. Yeah. So people always have this kind of imagined idea of what things would look like. The problem with the ANC is that it is intricately linked to their ideology and their dogma. And they cannot imagine any other universe or do any kind of comparative thought as to whether this school of thought will take you there faster or better or ensure more freedom or less freedom. And they bunker down and will not allow any other kind of ideological assessment to hold any weight in any regard. And that's how you become really myopic and ignorant and dangerous, in my view.
Right, I've been reading a lot of your stuff over the years, Gareth, and you've been consistent in your criticism of things like the death penalty, racial quotas, prescribed assets, state of emergency, all of these things. You've called them apartheid-style ideas, right? And they're now, some of them are making a massive return.
Yes.
Some of them are suddenly en vogue again.
Yes. Well, some of them have been for a while. I mean, there's actually a great piece to be written on a proper serious research piece on the number of ideas that sort of defined the main pillars of apartheid thought and how they're being reimagined today. I mean, this idea of quotas, Enoch Godongwana, who's the long-standing chair of the ANC's Economic Portfolio Committee and a right-hand man for Ramaphosa, is on record as saying, you know, Hendrik Verwoerd had quotas, so we will have quotas too.
What a place to take your cue.
Yes, and the death penalty was obviously a weapon of the state under apartheid, prescribed assets the National Party used for a long period of time, and a whole range of other ideas. Mm. And there's definitely an argument to be made that, you know, nationalists and nationalist parties tend to draw their ideas from the same pool, and it was almost inevitable that at some stage or other the ANC would explicitly start to follow the kind of policy program of the Nats.
But isn't it also just a kind of human behavioral quirk that when you're oppressed, you end up taking your best lessons for oppressing the next generation from your oppressors?
Yes, very rarely do oppressors, as you call them, have a fundamental problem with the idea of oppression itself. They all think they know how to best implement it. Mm-hmm. And the only problem with their predecessors was they got all the mechanics wrong,
right,
or they targeted the wrong group. Mm-hmm. But the actual machine, they like quite a lot.
Yeah. So it's not surprising that we're sitting with a lot of these ideas coming back into fashion.
Not at all.
All right. What about the issue that's gone quite quiet recently? I mean, I don't know whether it's just not as sexy as it used to be or not, but what about land? Because you would have thought that this would continue to be something which the EFF would use to drum up interest. Is it just because the elections are over now and nobody really cares? And they also know that land isn't the thing that most people are interested in.
Well, I think one of the reasons why the debate has sort of died down a bit is that there is a process in play, and the ANC is very good at using processes to kind of quell...
To bore you to death,
to lock you into their kind of grand ideological framework, and to quell sort of opposition voices out there. And, you know, everyone... This is one of the problems with the EFF. As I was saying earlier, if they legitimately are a revolutionary movement, they wouldn't care about the parliamentary process to establish expropriation and what the bill says and what subclause 5.3 says that they're going to argue in committee. They would be arguing their case as they did before the election with the same vigor and purpose. But because they're locked into that process, because the ANC suckered them in, they now have to consider this bill that the ANC has put forward and how to amend it to get what they want.
Can we talk about something you referred to just now about kangaroo courts and mob violence and mob justice? And there's some interesting statistics that you've spoken of before. 24 years after the formal abolition of the death penalty, the people carried out 789 public executions in the year 2018 and 19. This compares to 99 individuals executed by the state in 1982 during the apartheid era. Highest number of lynchings ever recorded in the USA was 231 in the year 1892. When we were all just emerging from primitive violence, right? On this statistic, Gareth van Onselen said, one of the most important stats in South Africa today is this, 789 public executions. In turn, how culture determines the real democratic nature of South Africa. And finally, interestingly, next to zero press reportage on this.
Yeah, well, there's a massive problem. Sorry, Catherine, I keep
running buttons. Go ahead, guys. We're not democratic about who gets the most airtime.
Right, excellent. one of the big problems with South Africa, as I intimated earlier, is that there is a disjuncture behind our kind of formal democratic or constitutional values and our sort of informal constitution as it is encapsulated by the kind of values that society out there has generally.
But do you think that's because the constitution was imposed upon people who might not otherwise have wanted it by a government that thought, well, this is for your own good?
Yes.
It tells you something about the way that the government feel about the people. Or yeah. Is it something that the people were just not ready to accept, but we would condition them and get them there?
Yes, probably a bit of both. And I don't think it's any bad thing. I think, you know, in general terms, I have my problems with the Constitution, but in general terms, the values that it embodies are good and healthy for South African society. I think if you had to leave it up to the people to determine a Constitution, we'd
disaster.
Have a very horrible state of affairs. Anyway, my point ultimately is that there's very little analysis of these kind of informal impulses and values that drive society. It's all done in kind of a formal constitutional framework, and I think you miss a lot of the real nature of South African society by doing that.
Well, I think that's probably true, but I guess the critical thing for me is that how do you actually fix this stuff? Because we're aware that all of... many people have been making the point that fundamentally, if you look at South African society right now, it is a state of anarchy. There has been a breakdown in terms of the state's ability to provide any of the things that they are supposed to be doing. And against that backdrop, people have been doing things at different levels depending on what community you're in. So for those of us who live in cities and are able to pay for armed response, that's how we are providing security services for ourselves, or, you know, we have things like medical aid, where you go into the rural areas and what are their alternatives in terms of actually providing some sort of security network for themselves? Well, they set up things like informal policing structures and lynchings. as a result of that.
And, well, and for burning witches, Kenton.
Yes.
And it's not all some kind of informal justice.
Absolutely correct. And I'm not trying to in any way suggest that I'm endorsing this stuff. But what I'm trying to suggest is that by simply breaking
you
it down.
You better not be.
By breaking it down and trying to get a sense of why it's happening, I think is actually a bit of a distraction from trying to go down the path of how do we actually fix this stuff so that we can get back on track in terms of a constitutional framework.
But, Kenton, I don't think a lot of people are that interested in actually figuring out how to fix these things themselves. They're looking for someone to fix these things for them. Mm. And there is this goes back to the discussion we had just a moment ago about how the state seems to be co-opted into almost all the important things that happen in people's lives now. Mm. People would almost prefer the state to be responsible for so much of this stuff rather than have to be responsible themselves, whether it's parenting, whether it's your space in the economy, whether it's your transport, whether it's your ability to be fed and clothed. Ultimately, there are lots and lots of people who, and I jokingly said to a friend of mine yesterday, because we were talking about how, you know, these days it's hard to hire people because conscientiousness is not present with many young people who come out of the current education system. And I'm not saying we need, like, corporal punishment, but certainly there seems to be a problem with self-discipline and with being accountable for yourself because it's something they don't see in politicians. They don't see in leaders, in inverted commas. So hiring for conscientiousness is a difficult business. And I jokingly said to a friend of mine who they're raising their children as well as they possibly can. And I said, the sad thing for your children is ultimately they're going to end up being very responsible adults, but they'll end up paying 98% tax for everyone else to kind of coast along and be looked after in welfare until they're 40. Mm. And this is the reality. You're going to end up with this dystopian situation where you end up almost with two kinds of people. The people who are doing and getting things done and solving problems and fixing SOEs and all kinds of other things, and the others who are just along for the ride. Do you think that's dramatic?
No, I think that's something that's pretty much already happening. Interesting figure yesterday, by the way, that VAT revenues are down.
Which means?
Well, that actually means that people are actually not spending as much as they used to.
And they're doing that because they have less money.
Yes.
And that's because the economy's not growing.
Exactly. And if you consider that VAT revenues are down year on year, in spite of the fact that we've had an increase in VAT as a percentage of, it went up one percentage point from 14 to 15.
So what's going to happen now? The fiscus is going to be under more pressure.
Well,
so they're
going
to come after more tax.
No, the middle class is going to be under more pressure because that really is the only place right now that they can squeeze.
Jeez, and even that is can they? You know, I think there's some kind of tipping point reaching. Reached with e-tolls.
Didn't Edward Kiswete say just the other day at a big tax symposium they had in Santon that we're on the verge of a tax revolution where people are going to just revolt and not pay tax?
Yes, and I think he's on the money, and there are lots of signs for that. I mean, the responses I said to e-tolls is one example of the middle class being pushed just too far. You know, Helen Ziller's promoting this idea of a tax revolt, which we actually polled during the election, and there is huge support for that idea, especially amongst the middle class. And, yeah, I think Kiswete is on the money. There is a zeitgeist out there that is on the margins, and if it's pushed any harder, something's going to break.
How would that happen, though? Because, you know, big companies, they take your tax off before you even have a say. And they're so careful to comply with government because a lot of their business is with government.
Well, the biggest way it's happening is migration.
Well, we already
are. And if you want to know how the tax revolt is actually working, it's really at that level. The sheer number of people that are packing up and leaving the country and going to other places just simply because that's one way of ensuring that you're getting value for money in terms of what you're working for.
Yeah.
And then couple that with the fact that employment numbers are down and employment numbers are going to continue to dwindle. So your ability to continue to squeeze that middle class becomes less efficient.
Yes, and as with all protests, probably start with something small and escalate. So, I mean, you know, Kenton's actually absolutely right about people leaving as being one of the ultimate kinds of protest, but people stop paying their TV licenses, people stop paying e-tolls, and you protest around these things and you build up momentum And then at some point or other, your
wall breaks.
I'm not doing my tax returns, and
and if enough people, they can't lock everyone up, right?
Yeah, I mean, if the middle class could actually mobilize in some kind of coherent way, they would have a lot of clout in South Africa. I mean, the state relies on them to be able to put together a budget every year. But there is actually no one who has them coordinated. I mean, if the EFF actually had the middle class as its constituency, South Africa would be a very different place.
Well, the difficulty that we have is that in order for us to have an effective tax revolt from a middle class point of view, we need to be in a scenario where every individual employee is in a position to insist that their employer does not deduct tax up front. And really what we need is a test case where someone is actually able to insist that their entire salary gets paid over to them, and the individual then takes responsibility for paying the money across to SARS, at which point the state literally collapses. And really we need to be at that point. And what we really need is a bunch of lawyers to come forward and actually put together something of a class action suit and actually take that the way to the court. And
I mean, it's a very good argument that it is morally unacceptable for someone to support theft on the scale that the state is thieving at the moment.
Absolutely correct. And
and if you're going to be part and parcel of that, then you're also morally deficient. Therefore, you can't claim to be a good person if you're allowing your money to be used for nefarious purposes.
Exactly. And you can get all of the religious institutions to actually come on board there, because, you know, certainly I cannot think of a single religious denomination that will be happy to support the idea of paying over taxes to an unjust state.
But just on that front, Gareth, I mean, this, you know, one of the interesting things about this whole approach to, I mean, look, the DA prides itself on being this party of service delivery and excellence and stuff. Herman Mashaba was doing the exact same thing that the ANC government does. Not necessarily with incompetence, but what he's basically saying to white middle-class ratepayers in Johannesburg, essentially, and black middle-class ratepayers to a certain degree, is you guys are not going to see a cent of that money spent in your suburbs or on anything that's in your line of sight. That stuff is all going to upgrade townships, you know, and the poor and the marginalized out there on the periphery of Johannesburg. And he's running exactly the same risk for, you know, slightly different reasons, because the DA has a different constituency to the ANC, of alienating his core support base and the ratepayers in the city of Johannesburg in an expense to, you know, use what revenue he can get to service townships and poor rural communities, or Johannesburg's rural fringes.
But to what avail? I mean, is he trying to gain their support?
I think he is A, completely apolitical, so he doesn't understand the consequences of, just never mind morals, from strict political terms of alienating your support base. I think he is completely enamored with the EFF, who put, because this is exactly what they would do. You know, white middle-class ratepayers are there essentially
to
fund.
They're just a cow that you can milk for resources.
Correct. And he sees it, he sees the EFF as his moral guide on this front, and wants to keep them on board, and agrees with their assessment, actually, in general terms. And those two things come together for someone who's just systematically alienating his base. And that's not to say you shouldn't use ratepayers' money to uplift those areas where
but not
that
exclusively.
Money can, you have
I mean, those
to
people
something.
Still need to be serviced. There's sewage going down the roads in Houghton.
Yeah, and they're paying for it. They're literally saying, oh, you know, I want a pothole fixed. I want my robots to work. Everything that's broken in the suburbs, I need some sign that you're going to deal with them.
I got delayed coming here by 5 minutes this morning because the traffic light at the intersection of Rivonia and 12th Avenue is out of action.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. Fix the flippant traffic lights. How difficult is this?
This is what you're paying for.
Yes.
And forget about your vote, but you're paying for this.
Yes, you need to give some sense of value for money if you're a core constituency, and you can't afford to take every cent and show nothing. It's going to hurt you in the long run.
All right, so is your advice that people shouldn't vote for Herman in the next election?
I'm definitely not voting. I voted for Herman in the last municipal elections. I'm definitely not doing so this time.
Okay. Well, I think the advice would be you need to do an assessment of your suburb, and has anything changed in it since Herman Majaba and the DA became mayor.
Certainly has not improved. All of the stuff that's happened in my suburb has come about because of the fact that we have a fairly active residents association, and we've been doing stuff out there to actually make things work.
I heard something interesting I'd like to have both of your thoughts on, and then I do want to talk quickly about a question that's come up from Leo about Ranjini Munsami. I don't know if you know what's happened there. But before we get to her, there was a really interesting conversation that took place around these Democrat debates in America. And the fact that now, because the local and the community, and you mentioned this with regard to your neighborhood, those structures are largely powerless and are falling apart in parts of this country and even in America. And people no longer see their immediate community as being the locus of power and the locus of change. They now... They delegate that all the way up the chain to the president, and suddenly the president's the only one who can really make things happen, which of course is nonsense. And America is still based on a federal system, and the president is only the last place that power can stop. He's not the most powerful person. In fact, your local state legislator should be, or your local community ward councillor should be. These are the people who should be making change. And in South Africa, obviously, that also should be the case. It certainly isn't. I saw in Klerksdorp this week, 6 ANC councillors' houses were set on fire by angry community mobs. What do we make of that? Where the power actually is?
Well, I think there is a lot of what you've described in South Africa today. I mean, you see it in a lot of service delivery riots. I mean, all that stuff that happened in Alexandra a few months ago. The first port of call is we want to see the premier, we want to see the president.
Yeah.
And that is a fairly typical behavior across the country. But I think there is a certain amount of class analysis that you can bring to bear to the thing. I mean, Canton's point about how active and powerful his residents' association is. You've seen the rise of these residents' associations all across the country. I mean, I think it is a kind of white middle class phenomenon, but some of them are incredibly powerful to the extent that they now stand in elections as political bodies and cause the DA in particular a lot of pain. And that is kind of the opposite of what you're saying. It's kind of, you know, people taking responsibility onto their own shoulders, building these kind of community-driven semi-private organizations that basically take charge of a municipality or area themselves. So I think both ends of the spectrum are at play in South Africa for different communities.
They also create economic and social exclusion zones, right? That's what they're doing.
Yes, it's like everything. They sort of, you treat your area, and it's perfectly understandable, your residency, your suburb, as a company of sorts. Yeah. And you raise capital from within it to get the private sector in to fix everything the state can't do.
And I think maybe there needs to be, again, we need lawyers here, but we need to be able to find a way that if a community is able to become more autonomous, they become responsible for their own water, their own sewerage, their own electricity, their own waste removal, all of those things that should be allowed. In fact, it should be encouraged, but then as a reward, those people shouldn't have to pay those municipal taxes.
Parkview should just take over the Zulek and turn it into a water reservoir.
There we go. I mean, why the hell not? It might be better utilized, and it might be better looked after.
I don't know about that. I mean, my liberal impulses get a bit checked when it comes to fundamental things like electricity and, well, maybe not electricity as much as something like water. I think you need to be very careful about how you manage something that is so fundamental to life in a way that's fair and equitable. You can't mess around with that stuff.
So we give it to the same people who ran Eskom into the ground to manage.
Look, I'm not saying I have a solution. I'm just saying you need to be very careful about privatizing something like water. It needs a lot of thought.
What do you think of this?
I think that as soon as I'm actually able to afford it, I am going to be sinking a borehole in my place and putting in a water purification system at my place.
Mm. I think we got to.
Yes, very much so. I mean, right now, I hate to think of what's going to happen if I actually run tests on the quality of the stuff that's coming out of our taps. because I'm pretty sure that it's fluctuating on a day-to-day basis, and people are actually not doing their work in terms of ensuring that the water supply that we currently get is not contaminated.
There are parts of South Africa where you can't drink the water anymore. People in Middelburg and Witbank have not been able to for the longest time. Poor, rich, doesn't matter who you are. You open that tap and you're drinking heavy metals.
Yep.
Not good.
Well, you know, one of the things that Eskom has done is taken the light away from all our other infrastructure problems, and I think water is one of the most critical. I've done some research into the kind of backlogs that the kind of things that we don't focus on because Eskom is so all-consuming: roads, water, electricity, railways, the conditions of our ports. Roads are a fascinating one. There are three different agencies or three different levels of state that look after roads: national, provincial, and municipal. And our road infrastructure is split between them. One of the problems with that is that you have no consolidated figure for our backlogs. You have a national number, you have a provincial, nine provincial numbers, and a myriad municipal ones. An attempt to work out that backlog, which I did by going through each provincial road agency, the national, and some of the metros, it is a number beyond comprehension. I mean, into a trillions of rands, probably. And the same kind of thing happens with water. You know, there are nine water boards. Municipalities are responsible for water. National is responsible for water. The Water and Sanitation Annual Report last year, I think, said that something like 40% of our water treatment plants are either broken or breaking. In other words, I can't remember what the formal definition is. There's no money for this stuff. These huge things are not seen, and then they manifest one day when bad water comes out of your tap, just like the lights go off one day because of load shedding, and then you will see panic like you haven't seen before when water goes wrong.
Yeah.
And we don't even know the real condition of these kind of things.
Well, we've also had the very salubrious water minister just prior to this, who, of course, ran the whole water department and sanitation department into the ground. Nomvula Mokonyane, right?
Oh, administratively,
she did a terrific job.
Yes, she turned. I mean, look, in her defense, quote unquote, so to speak, that department has been run like an absolute shambles from day one. So she's by no means exceptional as a water minister. I mean, those guys went through some extraordinary number of DGs over the last 15 years. And corruption and audits and disclaimers and forensic audits. That place has been a mess for 20 years administratively. And you can see it in the management of the water boards and the kind of infrastructure and money they get. That thing is just a total shambles.
So, again, take responsibility for yourself in this respect. As Canton says, if you can afford it, sink a borehole and make yourself independent of government as quickly as possible on the waterfront. Don't say we didn't warn you.
Yes. Well, I'd be interested to know what would happen if everyone in a community sank a borehole, whether you would have more water or just run out of it. It would be an interesting experiment in the private versus the public.
I happen to live in a neighborhood where the Yokeskey runs through it. And so I'm pretty sure that the water table is being replenished on a regular basis out
of
there.
Of course, all the filth in the Yokeskey stays on the surface, so you'll be fine if it gets through.
No, the whole idea is that you purify it after it comes up from the ground. But again, this is a very good example of where community action could actually work, because if you've got access to a regular and sustained water supply, which the Yokeskey is, because even in the middle of winter when there's no rainfall, it's still flowing. If you're actually able to then pump that up into a water tower and then filter it on the way down, you can actually provide a water supply for a specific neighborhood relatively efficiently. And it is one of those cases where it requires organization. You need to get the residents association together and say, guys, let's actually designate a property that we buy. So, in other words, you just buy one of the smaller properties in the area, put up a water tower on it, which then provides water for those in the neighborhood who actually want access to it. Of course, it then means that you need to tap into the pipes that are owned by the city of Johannesburg. But again, you launch a legal process to actually put that in place as well. And then shut down the pipeline of Mashaba's taking money that's meant to be fixing my suburb, and which he's plowing into the inner cities. By the way, apropos of those inner city renewal projects, I really want investigative journalists to take a look at who has been ending up with the contracts to pick up those buildings in the inner city and rejuvenate them and to do a paper trail in terms of exactly how they were chosen. Because we keep hearing about all of these. Look, essentially what he's done is he's taken inner city buildings, he's handed them over to groups of people and said, fix these, build schools, but he's given them the properties. Oh, you know, they're obviously owned by the city, but he's saying, run these things for us and turn it
and
into.
And who are they, is
what
you're asking.
Who are they, and what is the connection? What is the process by which they went out?
He must be leasing it to them, though.
Yes, exactly. Yes, but I still want to know, what is the process? How were they chosen? And what are the Venn diagrams that actually overlap there in terms of who these people are and who's going to be benefiting in the long term?
Finally, someone who has been politically and journalistically very active over the last while has suddenly found herself suspended from the publication that hires her, Ranjini Munsami. I'm not sure what the story is here. I'll plead ignorance right up front. But I know that this is breaking news from yesterday. Does anybody have any idea of what's going on there with Ranjini?
Look, essentially, there was something that was tabled before the commission. And you and I have had discussions previously around my difficulty around accusations that get tabled in the commission, because they have not yet been subject to due process. So what you have is an accusation by an individual that a payment was made. Obviously, everyone has climbed onto the bandwagon at this point. And understand that I'm not saying this at any level as a defense of Ranjini Munsami. I have absolute contempt for her journalistic norms, because remember, she was the person who actually sparked the entire HIFA commission.
Yeah,
and this was based on the fact that she had a story about the purported links between Bulani Guka and being an apartheid-era spy.
She's also the founder of the Friends of Jacob Zuma Foundation.
Yes, and you know, so going back to that that time, I certainly would not consider Ranjini to be a representative of what's best in the journalistic profession. But in the context of what's come out of the commission, I think everyone who's actually rushing through to follow the EFF narrative actually needs to back off. They need to wait until we actually have a smoking gun. We don't have one at this point. We have an accusation.
Yeah, it was 2003. I can't remember the policeman's name, but he was testifying before the commission. 2003, he said he'd uncovered evidence that the State Security Fund had paid, I think it was 144,000 rand towards Ranjini Munsami's car. And that's
paid off the finance account on Wes Bank, is what they said.
Yes. And yeah, I mean, 2003, she was, you know, in the thick of the Zuma camp. I think she was actually the administrator of the Friends of Jacob Zuma website as opposed to the founder of it. But, you know, whatever, she was very close to Zuma and his campaign and a confidant. And there were a whole lot of other problems, I think, with, you know, various stories at the Sunday Times and City Press and so on and so forth. But as Kenton says, you know, the stuff needs to be tested in a court of law, or at least before some kind of forensic institution that's able to say whether it's true or not. The implications, if it are true, are profound. If they're not, well, this is a problem for the State Security Fund, I guess.
Right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time this morning. The Burning Platform, as always, fiery as hell. You're welcome to listen to it from the start if you missed any of that, as a podcast available on cliffcentral.com. What are you holding in your hand there, Kenton?
This is the camshaft hall sensor that I spoke about two weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah, so I bought it, and this is the old one, and I fitted the new one to my car, which is now purring like a pussycat outside. But
you managed to be your own mechanic?
Well, yeah,
pretty much. You really are a survivalist.
you need to be in this country.
Do you also stockpile stuff?
No, not at all.
You don't?
No,
Gareth, do you think he'd tell you about his bunker if he had one?
Anybody who's hungry, thirsty, or desperate in the next couple of months when the zombie apocalypse comes.
I keep a list of vegans, because basically vegans will make the best eating when the zombie apocalypse comes. You know, they're grass-fed.
I put a picture of a paper straw up yesterday on Instagram and said, I fucking hate these things. They're the worst things ever. And obviously, that means I'm a terrible person and I'm anti the earth.
You're making a straw man argument at this point.
Yeah, so that's precisely the point. And I was attacked by a bunch of virtue signaling millennials. Do you like paper straws?
I don't like straws generally.
No, okay. I can't stand paper straws, and I'll vote for your party if you start.
Thank you very much. Mm. I was saying, and then my hashtags were damn you Al Gore and screw the earth and so on. So if you're still one of those people who believes that I'm the most evil person on earth, you need to figure out your priorities. There are a lot of people much closer to you that are doing a lot more damage.
That's the final straw we're closing on.
Very good. Thank you very much, Gareth van Onselen, Canton Pillay. Thank you to Nando's. Thank you to you.
This is CliffCentral.com.